Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Look up the description of schizophrenia at the National Institute of Mental Health and you won't find a lot of pussyfooting around with gentle language. It is described as a devastating brain disorder, one of the most chronic and disabling of all severe mental illnesses. It can mean hallucinations, paranoia, delusions, disordered behavior, and strange speech. There are over 2 million people in the United States who suffer from schizophrenia. Some are at home, some are homeless or in hospital. Some might well be driving that car beside you or working away at your office or your school. There have been advances in the understanding of the disorder, and the drugs are getting better. Yet it's always a remarkable achievement when someone afflicted with the illness is able to live the life that he or she imagined. Joe Vleklinski is one of these people. He's been suffering from acute schizophrenia for nearly 10 years, and this fall he's one of the students returning to his graduate classes in nuclear engineering at MIT. One of the hurdles Joe will always face is people who will see him first as a schizophrenic rather than a man with schizophrenia. Connection listeners, why are there so many misconceptions about mental illness? Does society's reaction to such disorders make it more difficult for people to return to a normal life? And what will it take for people like Joe Vleklinski to be accepted? Joe's here with me this hour. He's been struggling against schizophrenia since his early 20s when he was an undergraduate. He's now 28. He's resuming his graduate studies tomorrow in nuclear engineering at MIT. I'm delighted to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for coming in. Nuclear engineering, what's that specifically? What are you studying?
Well, the area that I'm a part of is the fusion effort, nuclear fusion, and I study theoretical plasma physics.
And this is at the master's level you're in right now?
It's both a master's and a PhD program. I'm currently about in between that right now.
Fairly intense level of study, though, it seems.
Yeah.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you care to join us on the phone. I want to talk a little bit, Joe, about the years behind you now. What was the moment when you or someone first thought, oh, I'm not just depressed, there may be something more wrong with me?
At first, it was definitely other people who thought that. I always thought I was just stressed, or would come up with some sort of explanation for what I was feeling, and it was only natural not to attribute it to some illness. I always thought it was just some sort of personality flaw or something like that.
People were saying to you what? What were they saying? Oh, you're too short with us, or you're too...
Right. Too stressed, too frustrated, too angry, things of that nature.
Is it part of schizophrenia that you don't want to accept that you have a disorder? Now that you can look back on it?
At first, yeah, but now I'm fine with it. I made peace with it.
There were, months, though, of going in and out of hospital.
Right.
As you sort of moved your way towards that.
Right.
Some of that sounds like it was pretty awful. I read a feature that Ellen Berry wrote in the Boston Globe about it, and she was quoting you as saying some of the hospitals she spent time in were just grim.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The first two times I was hospitalized, I was put in involuntarily, and that was very difficult, not wanting to be there and having to deal with the staff 24 hours a day. It was like you really couldn't get a break when you were in there. And but later on, when I did accept my illness, I managed to get to hospitals that did not have this sort of mental warfare going on, and also... with staff that I felt comfortable with.
In the hospitals where it was hard for you, was it because, again, looking back on it, you hadn't accepted that you had a mental illness, or the hospital wasn't accepting it either?
It was me who was not accepting it. The hospitals were just doing some things, more or less inhumane treatment.
Like what, tying you up or not feeding you?
Hospital where they didn't feed me, that's correct. Not nearly enough food. That was a state hospital back in Illinois. Other than that, they at times would, if you acted out, they would put you in restraints, give you a shot of Halidol usually. They might... they might verbally abuse you. That was one of the most difficult things to get over, because you felt like you were just not getting the respect you might even get on the street.
Can you recall a moment when, either with a doctor or on your own, you came to a realization, your own realization, that you had schizophrenia?
When I first was put in McLean Hospital here in Belmont, I was there for a long time, a couple of months, and I had a lot of time to think things out, as long as I had ever been in a hospital, my third time. And I remember seeing some things posted on the wall about schizophrenia, and I was thinking, wow, that's just almost a perfect fit for what I'm going through.
These were descriptions of symptoms?
Yeah. And so I was starting to believe that I maybe had an illness, and I asked my doctor there about what they thought, and he said that's what they were thinking as well. And he asked me if I was all right with that, and he was... It was very easy to take that, or I shouldn't say easy, but it was made easy by the doctor that was there. He did a good job of relating that to me.
Friends and family, were they supportive of you through this period? Did you feel at times that you know, you were more on your own than working it through with them?
At first, because what was going on was not really clear as to whether it was me just acting out. You know, my parents, for example, thought I did a lot of the things purposely that I did when I was ill. And so I was taking a lot of blame initially, but after basically my visit to McLean that I just described, my parents started to become supportive. Unfortunately, at that time, I had lost contact with some good friends who, I don't know whether they knew I had an illness or not, but mm-hmm. they just saw my behavior and they sort of moved away. And old mentors as well.
I gather you were a pretty bad driver for a period of time.
That's right, yeah. That's one of the very clear earmarks of the illness.
Is that what, speeding or just being abusive as a driver? Give me something specific.
A series of speeding tickets and... I totaled two cars, which somehow I had cleared from my record almost all of it, but my parents ended up taking my driver's license away for some time.
It's hard, I understand, to say this is what the illness is. It's part of what makes it hard for those of us who are learning about it, those who study it, and even people who, you know, have to endure the range of symptoms. I know you've said things like living outside of my feelings or living too far inside my feelings. Have you figured out a way of describing for lay people one experience or one sort of type of disorder that gives us some insight into schizophrenia?
Well, I think probably the chief characteristic is, other than disorder thought, which one can understand is just a type of heavy confusion.
A jumble.
Yeah. Is having psychotic thoughts, which is a feeling that in some way or another, in general, people are plotting against you. For example, when I get stressed, I tend to think that people are focusing on me and are aware that I'm stressed, and then I have all sorts of thoughts that could, you know, balloon from that. But I've sort of learned how to manage that at this point.
Is that using the atypical antipsychotic drugs? Is that ways of talking to yourself or putting yourself in a place where you can work it through? Is that a combination? How does that?
It's a combination. I have to severely put constraints on the environment I live in.
Give me an example of that sort of constraint.
I must live alone if I'm in school. I can get by living with my parents if I'm at home for a time, but even that is bad at this point in my life, mainly also for reasons of wanting to be independent.
Right.
But, for example, here at school, I just cannot function if I have somebody else, a roommate or or even I worry about the people next door sometimes. I just, because it's just too often that I need to be completely alone and focus completely on myself to try to reverse some of the reactions I might have.
I remember as a student in seminar classes where there, you know, wasn't necessarily 400 people in the room and I could be somewhat anonymous, finding it unbelievably stressful, knowing that I had to participate in a conversation, that I had to demonstrate my understanding in front of other people. I mean, that kind of stress, that's something that you need to learn to cope with as well?
Yes. When I was an undergraduate, I loved the classes that were large, huge lecture halls. It's kind of the opposite of what most people seem to tell me they liked. And but gradually, as I learned more about myself and the illness, I've been able to be in smaller classes and participate and things like that. It's a matter of self-confidence and knowing about any sort of reaction you might have and then being able to control it.
It also requires a lot of strength, I would imagine, too, because in nuclear engineering, you're using all your brain to figure out the complexity of what it is that you're trying to learn. It doesn't leave you a lot of space to say, you know, whatever it is you have to say to yourself, like, don't concentrate on that person who's sitting next to me. He's not looking at my notes. I need to pay attention to what's going on in class.
Right. I think that's the great thing about MIT is that everybody, I think, finds it easy at least to focus, to really put their mind into something. And it seems like everybody's doing that. And so I've been able to just let my mind get lost in the work. And I find that I have some of my most pleasant times doing that because I forget about my symptoms at that point.
You're at your best when you're seeing yourself clearly as a student.
Probably, yeah.
I mean, we all are, I suppose, in a way. You know, when a radio program's going well, I can sort of relax and be comfortable. You don't want to deal with all the clutter. You're going into your third semester graduate studies at MIT?
That's correct,
feeling
yeah.
confident, good about it, or also aware that this is a stressful time?
I'm feeling confident. The one thing that's come back is that I do get these memories as the weather starts to get a little cooler and more people show up on campus and classes start to begin. I get it's kind of an eerie feeling that I've sort of always had about the fall, but that's becoming sort of like an adolescent thing I'm growing out of, though. I'm not very worried about it. Because I have a clear agenda or objective as to what I need to accomplish this semester, and I think it's possible to do it.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joe Buklinski is my guest. When we come back, we'll be talking more with Joe. We'll also be talking with the director of the Bipolar Disorder Program at McLean Hospital for more about the disease. And we'd like to hear from you about why the misconceptions persist when it's possible to learn what we can learn. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Joe Buklinski's in the studio with me. He's a student of nuclear engineering at MIT. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 1990, it'd be about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Do you look at those 5 years as lost years?
In some ways, yes, because about the only thing I did was maybe take a couple of classes maybe at a community college during that time and published one paper. So that's about all I was able to do for my career at that point. But I did really learn a lot about myself and was able to see some other things. But in general, was ill, and I consider, unfortunately, about 50% of that time lost.
And can you use this time now to reconnect with friends and mentors and former students you know, in the way that you're talking as frankly as you are today about schizophrenia, or do you sort of concentrate on the here and now, what's ahead?
Well, it's been great, actually, having been written about in the Boston Globe last Sunday, because the reporter dug up a lot of things, wanted to speak to people in my past and so forth. And I had been thinking about contacting these people, because I sort of distanced myself from them, or they distanced themselves from me when I was ill. And so far, I've gotten nothing but good responses from these people. And I felt much better about that. So I hope to, you know, reunite with some people that I lost touch with.
I'd like to introduce another guest. Stephen Heckers is director of the Schizophrenia and Bipolar Disorder Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. He's also a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. It was his particular interest in schizophrenia which led him to his current medical studies. He's been sitting in the studio and listening as I've been chatting with Joe. When you listen to Joe articulate the past 5 years, Stephen, and where he is right now, is he giving us the insight into his own schizophrenia, into sort of classic symptoms of schizophrenia, or does the disease vary so much that there's no such thing as you know, sort of classic schizophrenia?
It's a very good question. First, I think we have to agree that Joe gave an excellent description of the last 5 years of what started it, and also that it took him a couple of months to realize that he was suffering from a mental illness. And that the third hospitalization for him really was the turning point. At that time, he had experienced the paranoia, the thoughts that other people might think bad things about him or might even harm him. Those are traditionally seen as one of the core symptoms of schizophrenia. But at the same time, he also was struggling with other aspects of his life. Things were too confusing. The senses were giving him too much of the material from the world, and he couldn't integrate it. As he said, things were jumbled. It was disordered.
And is that the difficulty that Joe would have been having with it at the time, part of what makes it difficult for friends, family, observers, to understand the disease? Because you know all the myths about people with schizophrenia are violent and they can't go to school and they can't go to work. Is the confusion that the people who are dealing with the disease have, is that why we end up being confused as well?
Yes, and that's clearly one of the major reasons why we, as people who don't experience those symptoms, have a very hard time sympathizing and understanding a patient or a person with a mental illness. And it took his parents some time to really come to the realization that he didn't voluntarily produce those symptoms, that he didn't crash two cars because he wanted to. Mm. So the first couple of years of a psychotic illness such as schizophrenia often remain unrecognized. And typically 2 to 3 years go by until a decision is made by the physicians and also the patients and the family members says, yes, this is an illness such as schizophrenia. And in the beginning, the hallucinations and the delusions are not as prominent, so it's not that easy always to diagnose it.
And is it, I mean, can we simplify this to the point of saying that the new generations of drugs that are available have made a big difference for people like Joe, people in Joe's situation, or that, you know, intervention, the doctor-patient relationship that you're describing is also and still remains an important part of the treatment?
There's no question that the current medication, which often is referred to as the second generation of antipsychotic medications, has made a tremendous impact. It has allowed patients to leave hospitals earlier, to stay outside of the hospital and to live in the community, to live independently like Joe does now. I just had the chance to talk with Joe for a couple of minutes before the show, and he mentioned that he's doing well on 4 different medications at this point. But they really have to be titrated well. They have to be in the right combination and the right dose for him to really live the life that he now can live. So yes, medication has made a tremendous impact.
Joe, I want to come back to you about this specifically, because there was one visit, I think, to a hospital in Illinois And this was a clinic that specialized in the care of unusually bright people like yourself. I can say that. You don't have to say that. Where the meds were adjusted and tuned for you, right?
Right. This was a research unit. And they were looking for some unusual people that fit certain profiles, and it just so happened that it was the perfect timing for me to go in there. I was in a state hospital, which was quite harsh, although it did have a sense of community that I have told others about. But it's quite harsh. For example, they weren't feeding me enough and things like that. But I only had to spend about a week there. Then I was shipped over to the research unit, and they did. They first got me. What they do there is they take you off of medications for a few days, assess your illness, and then put you on a particular research study, whereby you take medication, and then they assess blood levels of the medications or other things. And they started out doing this, but then I think after a few days they just said, we're going to treat you only, not do research. And it was another good hospital. I rank it up there with McLean here in Belmont. And a team of doctors went to work on me, team of doctors and social workers. And they started to put together the final combination of medications that I take now. And I had hit rock bottom at that point. I had a complete nervous breakdown and was in just a lot of pain day and night. I couldn't rest and so forth. And I started to climb out at that point, climb out of the hole. It was just a very helpful place, that particular hospital.
You're such a good student, so smart. I wonder whether or not, and you know that inside. I mean, maybe there's times when you question it, but I just wonder whether or not there's also times when you think, I can do this without the meds.
Yes, that has happened. One time I even went so far as to take myself off of the medications. I went through a very stressful period. I couldn't do much else except lie in bed and listen to music. I remember being so incoherent I couldn't walk down the street to a fast food place to get lunch. I also lost about 20 pounds in body weight. And I remember I was living at home at the time, and I was telling my father that I lost all this quote-unquote psychological weight. I feel so freed up and everything, and he was looking at me, knowing it was an unintentional lie, and saying, "Well, you don't look good," is what he said.
And since that time, is it like, let's not mess with the meds? They appear to be working.
Yes.
And you stay with them, and that's not something you question.
Right. There are a certain amount of side effects to deal with when you start up on meds, but typically those things the body adjusts to. And then one can get stable on the medications, provided through a trial and error process of trying new medications and tweaking their doses And then that's how I believe that the patient gets squared away.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. A number of people who want to join us on the phone. Let's go first to Newton, Massachusetts, and Kristen is joining us. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I guess I want to start out by just saying thank you very much for having this show. I have an older brother who's about 4 years older than I am, who was diagnosed in 1982 with schizophrenia. And it's been very good and interesting for me to hear about Joe. My brother isn't as, I guess, productive in his life as Joe is, and so it gives me, though, a lot of hope and just really happy that you're discussing this and that.
Where's your brother now, Kristen?
He's living by himself. He lives in Utah.
And he's on meds. He's had, he's 20 years now, right?
Yes, that's right. He's been on meds, and he's a brilliant young man, and eventually he didn't finish high school, and he ended up just he tried some part-time jobs, wasn't even able to hold on to any jobs. So at this point, he's just living on his own and just trying to survive. My parents' help. My parents have been extremely, extremely supportive. And that was another point I guess I wanted to quickly make, is the impact that it has on the family is you know, devastating as well.
I want to bring Stefan Hekkers in because you mentioned just offhand, Kristen, that your brother's very smart. And I know that with the film A Beautiful Mind that a lot of us saw about Professor Nash, and,
yeah.
and you know, as we're talking to Joe in his graduate studies at MIT, your brother, is there a link, Stefan, between really, really smart people and schizophrenia?
I have wondered about this for years. It's very difficult to study that question. I know several people similar to Joe who have very strong mathematical skills who ended up being diagnosed with schizophrenia. But I wouldn't go so far to say that the ability to be very smart, to be mathematically skilled, is a predisposition or a risk factor to develop a mental illness such as schizophrenia, since the vast majority of patients who get the diagnosis do not have these extraordinary skills. So there are examples, some very compelling examples, like Joe here today and also John Nash, mm-hmm. who clearly would fit that description. But it's a small group of people.
And just one other thing that Kristen mentioned, she said, listening to Joe talk and describing what he's doing and how well he's doing leads her to say that, you know, her brother's not doing as well.
Yep.
When you're giving advice to people
yep.
Who are suffering from schizophrenia, will you say, that's the best you're going to do, or that yep. things could get better?
That's, I think, one of the major tasks for a psychiatrist, to be able to predict or to at least give some assessments of how people will do in the future. And I think that over the years, research has shown that of all the people who have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, about a quarter, 25%, will do just fine. They will suffer through a period of schizophrenia, like Joe has for the last couple of years, but then can return to their lives. They can marry, they can have a family, they can keep a job. So about a quarter of all those people who have been diagnosed, who suffered clearly for years, can regain all their function that they had previously.
Joe,
on the other side of the spectrum, however, there's another 25% who will never regain the level of functioning that they had achieved before, and we have to also realize schizophrenia can be deadly, that 10% of all the persons with schizophrenia ultimately will kill themselves.
Joe, in the last 5 years, you must have thought a lot about whether you were in one 25% group or another 25% or in that 10% group.
Mm-hmm. I remember, my father can clearly testify to this. There was a period where I was finding it difficult. I really wanted to continue on with my education, but I was finding it difficult to even do algebra, and that doesn't get you very far in what I do today.
If it's any comfort, I never was able to do algebra.
But I don't think I would have made it, quite honestly, had I not been accepted to the hospital here in Belmont, Massachusetts, McLean Hospital, because I met so many people there who were either Harvard or MIT students who were currently in a program and had people outside of the program in their community who had high expectations of them and still maintained those high expectations even though they were just going through a period of illness. Or a period of greater illness than they usually experience. I think it's
the wrong care, the wrong environment. You might still be in a hospital today, is what you're saying.
Yes, if I wasn't exposed or was not people that I've met, doctors and my family did not have the same expectations of me that they had before the illness, which did change a little bit, I would not have been pushed to do the best I can. And I've made a lot of progress since January when I started up in the nuclear engineering program, because my advisor, who does not know about my illness, has just been, you know,
Your advisor doesn't know?
No, he does not know. I've kept it that way. Not that he would become biased if he knew, but I just decided it, I didn't need to tell him. It wasn't necessary. What he's done is he's pushed me, and I've just fallen back on the fact that I have felt healthy for the last about a year and a half now.
Well, he lets you be Joe Voklinsky the student, not Joe Voklinsky the student with schizophrenia. Right.
Right.
You mentioned one other thing I wanted to pick up on, and that was at the McLean Hospital, you met a number of other students from MIT or Harvard, or people from MIT, Harvard, who were role models for you. Do you have your own kind of personal theory about genius and schizophrenia, that it's a risk, a higher risk for people with a smart brain?
Honestly, what I believe is that schizophrenia affects the entire population, and the distribution of schizophrenia among people out there is the same as the distribution of talents and gifts that people have. So it doesn't choose. I don't think, from what I've read and what I've gathered by seeing people, that it chooses one person or another. I think it's it just affects the population in general, and that things like heredity are the major causes.
Right. There is another component, if I may add, which is that the fact that Joe had been able to attend college until he became sick. I think he was 22, 23 when he started having the symptoms and became diagnosed. And the fact that he had until then been able to function very well is a strong predictor that he will do well later on. The better you do before the illness, the better you will do after the illness has abated.
Okay, a little bit more about this when we come back after the break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Joe Voklinsky, who is a student in nuclear engineering at MIT, giving us insights into his own experience with schizophrenia. Our number, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My name is Dick Gordon. Joe Voklinsky is in the studio with me. He's a student of nuclear engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Stephen Heckers is also here. He's director of the Schizophrenia and Bipolar Disorder Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. Also is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. 1-800-423-8255. I know there's a number of you who want to join us, so let's go straight away to Greensboro, South Carolina. Sarah's joining us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how's it going?
It's great. How are you?
Good. I work at a mental hospital, and I'm one of the techs in North Carolina. And I was wondering, since I work with a lot of schizophrenics, since we were talking about family support and doctor support, what can we do for people who are unable to articulate what they're going through as well as Joe is, to help stabilize them with communication and confidence and everything? What is your suggestion?
What do you think, Joe?
Well, you're saying that the person is, did I hear you correctly, not capable of really communicating?
Most of them do not have a lot of insight on what they're going through.
Right.
But you can talk to them, right, Sarah?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
I would think questions regarding the basic symptoms and what's predicted statistically about people with schizophrenia or having psychotic episodes is the place to start. It's what doctors whom I initially saw did for me. They did things based on the statistical models.
Give me an example of something that they would do.
Well, they say, for example, the original diagnosis I had at one of my hospitals was that I had was going through a psychotic episode, and one of the statistical predictions for people who were going on a psychotic episode is that they should stay on medication for a 6-month period before anything else is tried. I think that's a place to start, but I'm definitely in favor of more personalized treatment. I think it's the, in fact, I think it's the only way to go at some point if somebody really wants to reverse their illness, if at all possible, and finally get control, complete control again. So I would think, the best I can say is to try to get that person to honestly say what they want to achieve, and in terms of just changing their behavior or getting rid of some symptoms.
You were saying a little bit earlier, Joe, excuse me for interrupting, mm-hmm. but I want to talk about this while Sarah's still with us, that you got a lot of support from other people who were going through schizophrenia, that somehow they were they more valuable to you than the medical professionals in helping you talk through certain psychotic episodes?
They were in some aspects. They could provide a relationship on equal footing. I would just feel completely at ease, as if I could talk about anything with these people that I had either met in the hospital or had met outside the hospital in day programs or just through the internet at schizophrenia websites. And it's just a connection
it's cleaner connection,
right?
I mean, Stefan Hecker's. This must be something that the medical profession is aware of.
Yes, I think that there really has been a change in this view over the last 20 years, that the traditional medical model always has been that on the one side were the treaters, on the other side the patient,
yeah.
And the treaters just decided for the patient what to do. Now, we know that in many other parts of medicine, including cancer or diabetes, for example, this model doesn't work very well either. But particularly in mental illness, this is not a model that's very effective. And we have now very compelling research that shows that the road to recovery is much better and much easier to be traveled if the patient is involved, if educational programs can really teach not only the patient but also friends and families about the illness, and also if peers get involved. If
you mean other fellow travelers, people
fellow
who have
travelers,
gone through these episodes, other schizophrenics. That's
like
sort of
Joe today, who
yeah.
does a great job in really articulating his experience and can really open the eyes for many people who are going through this right now, that there is some way out of this. Because ultimately, we have to understand that psychosis is nothing but trying to understand a very complex and confused world and to put meaning back into this. And a lot of delusions and paranoia are a desperate attempt to make meaning mm-hmm. out of a very confused sense of reality.
And you keep, when you read about it, you keep coming up against the word trust. Who do you trust? Who's giving you the straight goods, right?
Yes, absolutely.
That's cool. 1-800-423-8255. Sarah, I hope that's useful for you. Let's go next to Louisville, Kentucky. And Jeff's joining us. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Listen, you started the conversation with why does the rest of the population have prejudice against people with schizophrenia?
Right.
And your guest, Joe, he's an exceptional person. He's a graduate student at MIT, okay?
Yeah.
And I believe he's correct. I don't think schizophrenia picks and chooses the geniuses. I think it's spread over the rest of the population. My experience is I dated a girl in high school who had schizophrenia, or was developing into her schizophrenia. And what you end up with is a paranoid person. And the first caller alluded to this. This is really what I think she was asking. How do you get the trust of a person who's paranoid? They don't trust what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the normal cues, body cues, that people who are not schizophrenic use to judge whether a person's being honest, they don't seem to believe you.
You mean
it doesn't matter that you really care for them. It just doesn't seem to cross to them. They don't seem to believe you.
So you're in a position where you're trying to be the person that they trust, and you're trying to figure out how to do that?
No, I'm saying that I've already been through that. It's almost impossible to gain the trust of a person who's paranoid. When they have, when Joe got his medication right, and he gets to sit back and look at the world calmly,
yeah.
he sees that, people thought that he was short, okay? But I bet really what was going on was he didn't have the patience for them. Because he really didn't trust them. He really trusted himself more than he trusted them. And that's the paranoid part of schizophrenia. The people, and once you've been burned once, you know, you ask why the rest of the population has these stereotypes against people with schizophrenia. Once you've tried really hard to communicate with somebody who will not accept what you have to say,
mm-hmm.
you tend to believe that the rest of the people who are schizophrenic are going to treat you exactly the same way. They simply won't believe the words that come out of your mouth, that they will have their own reality based on their perceptions, that and their brain doesn't work like yours. So their perceptions are totally different than yours.
Let's bring Joe in on this, because
yes,
we're talking about him almost in the third person.
I can say something about that from my experience. What was the problem with me was that I was so weakened and paranoid and so forth that I just simply wasn't capable of understanding the mindset of the others that I was talking with. And I think trust, that's a first requirement for trust. And if you're not just not able to relate to that person or perhaps are having all these intrusive thoughts about that person while you're talking to them, it's extremely difficult to maybe siphon out which is the correct perception and which is delusional. And usually the two get mixed, and there's almost nothing that one can do about it. Honestly, for me, to get past that point, I had to find a certain medication that would get me past that point. And what I remember going on one in particular, and it just rose me out of this depressed, paranoid state. I just no longer had those thoughts, and all of a sudden, I was getting back to my old self, back in high school and so forth, mostly high school. And then was able to actually relate to people, and that's just the way it worked for me. I don't know a whole lot. I mean, I have talked with other schizophrenics, but probably would not be able to say if that's the way it is for everybody. But
I'm glad actually Jeff asked the question, because it does bring us back to where we began with a question about why it is society has so many misconceptions, and he talks about his experience. Stefan, is there something that in your research, in your own experience, you can say, look, this is what you need to know. This is how you avoid the awkwardness that Jeff was talking about.
I think that Jeff makes a very compelling case for somebody who's trying to understand and relate to a person with a mental illness. He talked about somebody he dated in high school, and he tried to overcome this resistance and the frank paranoia. And what we have to realize as family members and also as treaters is that madness is a foreign country. This is not something that we can easily communicate in, and we might never really find our way through that territory. And we have to accept this limitation of insight. And we have to then really work on trying to get the patient, the person with the mental illness, to agree to at least some step in the direction to take medication, to be in an alliance with the treater, to then work on overcoming this very difficult time and coming out of this madness. I think that's something that we have to accept. Now, there are many other theories that we can use that are brain-based, that we can try to understand on a rational level how the brain gives rise to a troubled mind. This really is ultimately, to me, the most important question, how we as human beings, endowed with something as complex as the human brain, can give rise to very creative minds, but at the same time also these minds can go awry and can give rise to schizophrenia. How is this possible? What has to go wrong with our senses and the integration of all this so that we have confusion and paranoia?
Do you ever think, Joe, about it in those terms of a foreign country where you speak, a foreign language, you use a different currency? It's, you know, there's almost no way in.
Yeah, I definitely felt that. I felt isolated, left out. During my worst times, I felt like I was perpetually walking on a mental minefield of pitfalls that I would run into, bad feelings and so forth, things associated with the illness.
Do you feel at any point that you have something to prove. Is that a part of where you go for the confidence? I mean, I was thinking about it last night, how much confidence it would take for you to come and talk about this on a radio program. And whether or not that's, you know, tied up with a part of you that says, you know what, piece of cake, I can do this. I'm sort of past the worst of it.
Yeah, I would say that, what you just said, past the worst of it. I think there hasn't been in a long time any sort of reaction I would have that I haven't taken the time to understand and have successfully understood it. So that's what brings the confidence. And
how far do you allow yourself to dream? There was a time you wanted to be a university professor. Do you still want to be a university professor?
Well, I do, you know, I do. But I think what I'll end up going into is to be a full-time researcher at a national lab or something like that. Yeah.
A place that gives you a little bit more privacy, a little less face-to-face stress.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because I have to accept that although I'm doing well at this point, I don't think I have the ability to stay healthy enough, or maybe the skills required to be a professor. But I think I'd almost rather do full-time research. So I'm very hopeful about that.
Because you can say to yourself, this I know I can do, and set a goal that you know is realistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's been great to have you in the studio talking about it. I'm humbled by your frankness over this. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Joe Wilczynski, graduate student in nuclear engineering at MIT. Stefan Heckers, thank you so much
for having me.
Stefan is director of the Schizophrenia and Bipolar Disorder Program at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. And you can find Ellen Berry's article about Joe, which was published this weekend in the Boston Globe. We have a link to it at our website. We're at theconnection.org. Thanks also to Della Burns at Eli Lilly. Eli Lilly is participating in a scholarship program, provides a little bit of money to help Joe stay at MIT. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.